From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome to Scared Monkeys Radio. We're going to start out with Blink, our sister blogger from Blink on Crime, but I want to share some breaking news with you. It looks like the world's oldest woman has passed away at 116 in Georgia. Bessie Cooper, I'm not sure Blink knows her or not, passed away Tuesday afternoon, and we send our condolences on to Bessie's family. So now we have Blink from Blink on Crime, who I believe is now the second oldest woman in the next
No. I was going to say, I'm just slightly younger than Mrs. Cooper, God rest her soul. How are you?
I'm good. 116, that's not bad.
I'm going to be honest. I have no desire to live that long.
Well, you know, I'm looking at a picture of Bessie, and she looks pretty good for 116. I wouldn't have put her over 112 at least.
Well, that's a goal then. If I got to be here, I would want to look my best.
Speaking of looking our best, and or looking our worst, I should say, in the Anthony case, you and I had a conversation just after the verdict. We kind of did a final show and talked about the, you know, jury and all that sort of stuff. And we figured that, you know, there's the civil stuff with Zanny the nanny and all that, but we probably wouldn't be talking about it much more. But just like a bad rash, it showed up again. And this time there's some people with some egg on their faces, and let's talk about that a bit.
Yeah, it's just not, I don't know that you could say that this case didn't captivate a nation more than most, you know, like that, since probably OJ, if I had to, you know, draw a parallel. So those of us that were very much on the side of feeling that while she may not have been, she may have been overcharged, per se, I definitely believe that she caused the death of her daughter, Kaylee.
Absolutely.
There's no question in my mind. I'm adamant. I'm on the record. So it's a difficult case. I didn't write about the developments for two reasons. One is because of what you said. You know, I dubbed her the C word and was not likely to give her much more press. And the other is because, you know, frankly, this isn't new information. And I have a level of involvement in it.
And I know that. And I want you to explain that, because I'm a little puzzled with the media. This, for those that have covered it from stem to stern, like you, this, like you say, isn't new. Let's talk about that more.
Well, in December 2009, I published a piece that was intentionally written to provoke the question as to the computer searches that I knew that the prosecution was alleging belonged to Casey actually belonged to George Anthony. And to this day, I believe that's the case. What does that do to the prosecution? If you believe that, then a large part of your case as it relates to the chloroform, the notion, goes away. So you go, you know, not that they ever had a murder weapon per se, but the intimation was clearly based on the finding of chloroform and the tests that were done. Could Jeff Ashton say that's how she killed her? No, it's not the burden of that court to be able to do that. Now, I also, while it's not the burden, I can also tell you that very likely that is one of the major reasons why Casey Anthony was acquitted, because in not presenting the full picture, when you don't have, you know, direct evidence, you're leaving that up to jurors, you know, in what I call, you've heard me refer to as the CSI Society,
right?
Because we've got every hour show that, you know, Criminal Minds is one that is wrapping up these cases in an hour, and showing how direct evidence and forensics solve cases. So if I'm sitting on a jury, you know, outside of the fact that this, you know, my feelings on high-profile and sequestered juries, outside of that, you know, this just was too much to ask a jury to come up with on their own. When we talk about these records, what I find upsetting, and I'm going to be careful on how I word this. I can tell you as an absolute point of fact that Orange County Sheriff's Office was in possession of these records and were told expressly that my analysis did not prove out that that was Casey Anthony, because within those records there are transactions that are encrypted. They're 128-bit encryptions. There are bank transactions. How difficult really would it have been to subpoena those individual transaction records to find out who they belong to?
Blink from Blink on Crime is here. We'll get back to the George Anthony aspect in a minute, but what about Jose Baez? And of course, he's trying to sell a book. We understand that, but what about his claim that they knew about it all along and they're surprised
right.
the prosecution didn't bring
it
up?
They learned it from my site. I have a screen capture of his office looking at it.
I know, and I'm not surprised that you gave that answer. But what about the media? How do we explain this?
First of all, it's not news, and Tony Pipitone, I think, has done some good work. I don't suggest that he hasn't. I recall having a conversation with Mr. Pipitone way back when, but I couldn't tell you from my notes because I would not go on the record with that. Obviously, we're here to protect a prosecution, not, you know, and so how that gets handled in my mind is important. You know, I've never, as you know, in any case that we act as a pseudo agency of law enforcement in something that I'm involved in or cover, I'm never going to, you know, it's not about news. It's about making sure that evidence is sent to the place it needs to go for processing.
Right.
Before, you know, I'm going to say, look, I'm the first one to discover this. That's not how I roll. Probably makes me a bad journalist, but, you know. So I don't recall that we discussed that specifically. I only had one conversation with him, and he called me. But it's not news. I mean, if you read the data, if you take the time to go through it, there's a significant question, and that question was raised prior to start of the voir dire of the jury at length.
What about the claim, again, I'm sourcing the media, and I probably shouldn't do that, that the FBI offered to help and they were turned down?
I can tell you that the Mr. Stainer, who was the analyst for the Orange County Sheriff's Office
right.
for these files, I can tell you that he was approached at least twice and said, look, you know, I have this resource. I'm intentionally protecting a source here, but
sure.
I have this resource, and she's saying that, this is her analysis, and he specifically said on both of those occasions she's wrong. And I said, tell him to check it again. And I know that where, you know, my sources are and my context, I am 100% positive that that conversation took place. I don't know where it went from there. Except that I know that he repeated himself and said, you know, I do work for the Secret Service.
Mm-hmm.
She's wrong. Well, and not just that, but then when we get down to, if you recall, at trial, which absolutely could have resulted in a reversible error had there been a successful prosecution in this case, the two different data sources that were analyzing this data didn't even agree with each other.
Yeah.
And put the prosecution in a position where she referenced, Linda Drane Burdick referenced in open court that the search for chloroform or something along those lines occurred 80-some times in a report. It was just wrong. And so when you look at that, you know, what's the root cause? Because that's really the question, right?
Right.
Where did this ball get dropped? And I think it comes down to a couple things. I think it's somewhat disingenuous for Jeff Ashton to say, "I wish we knew that." In fact, when I say disingenuous, I'm being kind, because he did. Now, did he trust his resource? Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's a true statement. But it's also his job and Linda's job. Linda's lead was the lead prosecutor in the case, so
right.
It's effectively hers. It's also their job to know their case and define their case in chief with the appropriate strategy as it relates to, you know, what they're charging the offender with or you know, the defendant with. So it's their responsibility too. You know, it can't just be we get to blow back on law enforcement because we needed this and we didn't get it. I don't think that's a fair assessment, because I know that not even Stainer got the other asset, the other resource that they utilized. They didn't even get his report. So if the FBI was offering their services, it could have only helped them. Now, I don't know that that's a true statement, but I do know that up until this time, at least, that Mr. Stainer was considered very well qualified within different law enforcement agencies and not just Orange County Sheriff's Office.
Right.
Unfortunately, you know, I don't know if that was overstated, but I know that when people are telling you something, you should probably at least check and, you know, check out what the allegation is, and I don't feel like that was done. Now, when you're in Florida too, Dana, when you have everything discoverable and you have the sunshine laws and you have this, that, and the other thing, that also is going to tip off the defense that you have issues with your own data, if that makes sense.
Right, sure.
So I don't know if that was a strategy, because then what happens is the case in chief looks bad, but, you know, again, the prosecution is tasked. The burden is theirs. It belongs to them to prove the what they're charging the defendant with beyond and to exclusion of any reasonable doubt.
Well, you used the term disingenuous, and the media that we saw with this latest conundrum in the Anthony case, the law enforcement are falling on the sword, so to speak. The big shots in the media, the O'Reillys, et cetera, saying, well, if the dumb cop only knew how to spell suffocation, this would never have happened. Your thoughts?
I think it's very I'm not one to bash law enforcement. I think in this case, it's very unfortunate that the amount of trust that was placed in a resource was not overseen more carefully at that level, and also from the prosecution's diligence for their own case. Once it's, you know, the investigative end is done, they own that data.
Exactly.
And more to that, once, think of it this way, once the trial starts, once, you know, you have day one of voir dire, in any respect, every law enforcement officer, every asset on this case is invoked. So they may not speak about this case at all to anybody. They can't watch it. They can't, you know, refer to any testimony. I'm familiar with law enforcement officers in this case that would go to get a haircut. Have to tell the barber to turn the television off.
Yeah,
because they weren't allowed to watch it. So then you have that issue. So once it's in the till, so to speak, you can't communicate about some of these issues. And so, as I said, I can tell you that as a point in fact, it was addressed to the point where I think it might be a fair statement to say somebody you and I know fairly well had a mini fit. you saw the result. It doesn't, at the end of the day, you know, she was acquitted.
Yeah, Blink from Blink on Crimes here. I want to touch on this just a little bit more, and then we'll get into the Kyron Horman case. Of course, Blink's website, blinkoncrime.com. Let's talk about George Anthony. And he's doing these searches. Why?
In my opinion, and what I wrote,
yeah.
He's he's got a fetish for porn. And when I say my opinion, I'm telling you that based on the results of the search data that I pulled, which I went through every one of those individual sites and records personally. So I'm not saying that it's my opinion. I'm saying if you can prove that that was George Anthony, it was somebody in the house.
Sure.
And we know who it wasn't. If you match that up against the cell records, guess what? You can't be two places at one time. And so George had a porn issue. Within one of the fetish sites, and I wrote about this, there was you're familiar with, well, not you personally, but you're familiar with cases that involve the autoerotica asphyxiation?
Yes.
Well, those were searched. And they use, some of them in place of that, use or attempt to use a level of chloroform. Mm-hmm. I believe that that's where that came from. It was you know, a resource. Now, I also can tell you that there were transactions within that search to escorts and what are called outcalls. If you need me to expand on that.
No.
What do you think of a bank transaction and then the next site of navigation is a calendar on an escort site requesting an outcall?
Sure.
And then that navigation, that computer, is not used for a couple of hours until later in the afternoon.
Maybe, yeah.
But see, the point I'm trying to express is this was simple.
Absolutely.
This was not difficult to review, and it's certainly worth the question. So I want to know why they didn't ask the question, and here's, you know, the rhetorical answer.
Yeah.
For whatever reason I will never understand, they absolutely banked their case on George and Cindy Anthony and thought that Cindy especially was going to be truthful with them once she was, when they had had the whole falling out where they were made aware that Jose Baez was going to start in his opening argument, admit Kaylee was deceased and that George was there.
Right.
And that he had sexually abused Casey. That didn't matter. That didn't matter to Cindy. She still went up there and lied about her employment records.
Yeah.
I have no idea why they took them at that value, other than to say that's how they saw their case, instead of adjusting the charges to what they could prove. Nobody really believed that, not really, in any of us, you know, that are involved in criminal investigative analysis, believed she premeditated, you know, dumped chloroform in the trunk, murdered the child, dumped her into this. I can tell you that most people believe that either as an act of rage or as an accident,
yep,
of some kind, Casey Anthony killed her child or was responsible for the death of her child. The community felt she was overcharged. Now, if you believe that the chloroform was the weapon, which the prosecution did, then they didn't act in bad faith in making this a capital case. And it would, that wouldn't be a true statement. But you couldn't prove it. So why wouldn't you just go with what you could prove? At that time, it was, you know, the media sensation. Yep. It was keeping Nancy Grace on with 14 minutes every single night of the same intro. She had a part, you know how hard it is sometimes, Dana, to fill a show. Well, she had 14 minutes taken care of for like 18 months.
Exactly, yeah. And now with the media grabbing this, albeit a week or so ago, and throwing out headlines like, can she be retried and all that, anybody with some knowledge will know that's a bunch of nonsense. But what about all the talk about the jury, how the jury got it wrong and all that? Well,
they did. You know, here's, first of all, let me address the point about, when you say, you're talking about Casey being,
retried.
People are saying she should be retried. That,
right.
That's never going to happen.
Yeah.
It won't happen under our Constitution. She would be in what's called in jeopardy,
right.
Because she was already in jeopardy once by being at trial. She was accused and she was acquitted. She could literally stand in the middle of the street and scream every detail of what happened.
Yep.
And there is nothing anybody could ever do to her. And when you have parents that are apparently willing to take $600,000 to perpetuate the case and make money on it, you're not looking at a wrongful death suit either.
No.
So, you know, or Son of Sam infraction of some kind, which has been challenged fairly successfully in Florida anyway. So, you know, sometimes, you know, I think you and I have talked about this, sometimes the moral of the story isn't going to be, you know, the white hats.
No.
And that's just life.
It isn't. It's so sad. You know, you think of that little girl and, you know, you still see her picture and all the coverage and everybody that covered it. And like you say, the Nancy Graces of the world survived on this for a long, long time. And, well, you know, there's a special form of justice that's out there. When you get it is when you get it. And I'm sure that Casey Anthony will answer for the death of Kaylee one day. Blink from Blink on Crime is here. Let's talk a little bit about Kyron Horman. You do have some interesting information on your website about a civil suit. Let's talk about that.
Yes. Kyron Horman, as you know, has been missing since June 2010, June 4th. He was last seen at Skyline Elementary School, and he was not, contrary to popular belief, contrary to what up until about a week and a half ago, news reports relayed that he was last seen with his stepmother, Terry Horman. That's incorrect. And I believe what you're seeing now is, and this is my opinion, because it's all sealed in the recent developments. To backtrack a second, Desiree Young, Kyron's biological mother, filed a civil suit against Terry Horman, and she alleged in that suit that either she herself kidnapped the child,
right,
or had him secreted away with help, that he was either taken out of the state or that he was deceased, and she claimed that she was filing that suit for answers. She was going to make Terry Horman talk. Rarely do you see, well, let me back up. I don't know if Terry Horman was involved in this.
Right.
I can tell you I have not seen any evidence that suggests that she was. In fact, I've mostly seen evidence that would make me doubt that theory tremendously. And so, you know, I've been quite, I'll call moderate in the way that I handle my coverage of it, because that's how I'm looking at it. I've never seen a case where law enforcement hurtles down a path of a suspect like a, you know, speeding locomotive, and all of a sudden, all the engines squeal, and no arrest. This woman hasn't even gotten a ticket for jaywalking, yet she had her divorce was abated. She was granted, her estranged husband, Kane, was granted a restraining order three separate times, saying she was a potential danger to her child, and she didn't fight it. So people naturally, and I don't blame them, are going, why is this woman not, you know, she didn't do anything, why isn't she saying, I didn't do anything? Well, I'll tell you why. Because the theory is that she may have had an affair of some type with a gentleman by the name of Rudy Sanchez, and he alleged that he was a murder-for-hire resource. And in fact, in a ruse, law enforcement put somebody undercover at the house after they, you know, made, you know, asked Kane to take the baby and move out while this was going on, and he shows up at the door, asks for $10,000. What does she do? She calls 911.
Right.
So I don't know about you, but if I'm, you know, if I'm being, what she knew was filed, if I'm being challenged about a crime in general, I'm not calling 911 and alerting that. They didn't plan for that. But at any rate, so where we are is on Monday, the 21st of November, the judge in the civil case, and this order is missing. Nobody can get it. It's not even on the docket. Grants him, I don't know if it was by motion or not, but it's a protective order that allows both the plaintiff, Desiree Young, and the defendant, Terry Horman, to utilize medical records in this case. Now, that's unheard of for both the plaintiff and the defendant. there has to be some sort of precursor for that to happen.
Right.
In other words, there had to be some type of good faith or prima facie, what's called a, you know, show of faith, that those were applicable. And I can't recall where the defendant has also been granted that. Well, as soon as that happens, the afternoon that that hits, Rod Underhill, the DA in Multnomah County, files this motion for abatement on the civil suit. This is the same DA that the Judge Cantor called on his own. He has no standing in this case, in a civil case. On his own, calls him to find out what his position is when this, when the original abatement hearing is occurred, and he says, "I have no position on it." Well, what changed?
Yeah. Exactly. Have any hearings been scheduled for this?
There was a hearing scheduled for the 14th to compel testimony from Dee Dee Spicer, who was a friend of Terry Hormones, and some people believe is a key to the case, that she had been, you know, missing out, you know, outside or unaccounted for. I personally don't believe she knows anything. I think they, you know, when you talk about people that have, that go through three or four different interviews, 5 and 6 hours at a time with law enforcement, you and I both know that as that's going on, and the patience is wearing, when you're not telling law enforcement what they think you know what that dialogue looks like.
Yeah, I've been there a couple times, yeah.
Exactly. I'm like, oh, are you really going to want to spend the rest of your life in jail for this?
Yeah.
Woman, you know, things along those lines, and that happened. So it shouldn't surprise anybody that at that point, you know, somebody's going to hire an attorney and, you know, stop talking. The major public sentiment is this case is one bungled hot mess of an investigation. How, you know, the child clearly was last seen at Skyline School.
Right.
And they were not named in the civil suit. I can tell you that is a major issue. That makes no sense to anybody. If you're filing a lawsuit for answers, the first place you look in an, you know, in an explosion is Ground Zero.
Yeah, usually.
That's, you know, Investigative 101. Yeah. And they were not named. And I think that was a huge mistake. Nobody's talking. There is no gag order. I have heard the press cover it that way. That's not correct. But nobody's talking, and I find that extremely odd. And if you look at the order and the excerpts from the order that were available, whatever this information is that Rod Underhill is trying to protect, in my opinion, it goes away from Terry Horman.
Well, be interesting to see for sure. Listen, I'll give you the last 30 seconds. What's coming up next on Blink on Crime? You're a busy gal. I don't know how you get to do what you do.
I know, and I'll tell you, I'm not deciding yet what it is, but I'm covering a major old case.
Oh, okay.
And don't say it, because I asked you a question about it a couple of weeks ago before I started to decide whether or not I was going to write on it. So
I know.
We're going to follow our normal progress, of course, and, you know, maybe we'll chat about that over an end of the year show. But I am working on a voluminous, very old case of the kind that causes and stirs major debate among true crime buffs.
Good, and I'm looking forward to talking about that. Blink, always a pleasure.
I appreciate it. Take care. Be well.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Blink from Blink on Crime. And, yeah, if you want to know more information about these cases or other high-profile cases, and not so much just high-profile ones. Sometimes it's the cases that don't get to be heard but need to be heard. Go to blinkoncrime.com. That's our sister blog. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with a crime reporter, Mike McIntyre from the Winnipeg Free Press. We're going to talk about the Graeme James case. That's the former hockey coach. His sentence has been appealed, and the Crown is trying to get more time for Mr. James. And we're going to talk about a case here actually in Saskatchewan where some convicts, some those prisoners, some thugs in jail, we call this the Hug-a-Thug segment, are suing for, well, you won't believe this. It's unbelievable. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back with Mike McIntyre here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
The Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio will be right back.
Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We all know Mike McIntyre is an author of true crime books. He's a Winnipeg Free Press crime reporter and, of course, the host of Crime and Punishment, the syndicated radio show on Ralco and Chorus Radio Networks. Welcome, Mike.
Hey, good to be here. Always nice to chat with you, Dana.
What's this? Inmates, I think they're in Saskatchewan, where I am, are suing the feds over what we call a feeling of hopelessness. Now, I read this on Sun News, and I had to get up and shake my head and then read it again. They are saying, these poor guys are saying, there's five of them, that they suffer sleep deprivation. They have to self-deaden in order to cope. They can't enjoy mutuality. I can't even say that. Connectivity and meaning, making fear in their futures, and they're overwhelmed with hopelessness and erosion of self-worth, and I'm starting to tear up and play a violin. What is going on here?
Well, newsflash, prison isn't always a nice place, although Canadian prisons have long had the reputation of being fairly posh when you compare them even to American prisons, but certainly when you look at foreign countries and the types of prison environments there. I mean, Canada is a country club, so it's interesting, and you wonder sometimes, you know, we're not a very litigious country here in Canada, not like the U.S., Dana, where everybody sues over everything and, you know, people get awarded thousands of dollars for spilling hot coffee on themselves, and, I mean, everybody... We've all seen those ads, right, with lawyers advertising on TV, you know, to sue this person and that person. It's not quite the same in Canada, but you do wonder if this is a case of an overzealous lawyer or group of lawyers who've got this bright idea to try and maybe get some money out of the federal government. I think they're seeking $50,000 in damages. That'd be a lot of money, a lot of scratch for an inmate, that's for sure. You could buy a lot of contraband cigarettes and booze, I guess, with 50 G's. But yeah, I mean, it is a bit laughable in that, you know, what they're citing is just a general sense of hopelessness behind bars. Well, that's what prison is.
Exactly.
In the case of one of these people who's suing, in fact, this is a guy who is serving a life sentence, his second life sentence, in fact, for killing a sexual-based murder of a 17-year-old girl in Calgary that happened back in 1982. I mean, I think most of the country would hope that a guy like that feels pretty hopeless. He's a murderer.
Yeah. Another one, Harvey Andres, according to the article, is a motorcycle gang member convicted of rape and murder who's tried multiple times to break out of prison, and he's feeling hopeless.
It's rather ironic because, of course, in Canada, even when we give life sentences, hopeless isn't a word in our vocabulary normally because we allow even the most sadistic of our killers to have a sense of hope because they can always apply for parole.
Yeah.
If you're convicted of first degree, you got to wait 25 years. But even if you're convicted of multiple murders, you know, you can be a serial killer in Canada, and you still have that light, that glimmer of hope that you might one day get out. Not the same in the U.S. I mean, there's real hopelessness in a U.S. prison. And so, you know, I found the timing of this kind of interesting too, Dana. I don't know if you saw the story out of, I believe it was South Carolina yesterday, where there's an investigation underway, actually, in a prison where, and this has now been proven to have happened, guards in one South Carolina prison were actually terrorizing inmates by, this may be a little difficult for people to hear, putting hot sauce on their genitals in prison. I mean, there's a sense of hopelessness there, and there's grounds for a lawsuit. This, here in Canada, all seems to be rather laughable.
Well, when we talk about the Canadian system and to quote the article, the hug-a-thug mentality that Canadians have, it makes you sit and wonder, does the rehabilitative state that we use, and love it or hate it, that's what we have here. We like to rehabilitate the people behind bars. Maybe some can, some can't, that's for sure. Is it something that we need to look at and maybe change?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I'll never forget an interview I did years ago with an inmate who was a notorious drug dealer slash trafficker. He was having these huge grow-ops in Manitoba. Excuse me. And he ended up defending himself at trial. He was quite a character. But he talked rather candidly about his time in prison, because he had been in and out, and he did some time at Rockwood, as it's known in Manitoba. Now, Rockwood is a minimum security facility where inmates literally can come and go. I mean, very few actually escape from Rockwood, because people there are on the verge of being released anyways, and if you just, if you were to escape by walking away, you know, you'd do yourself a great disservice. But this individual, his name was Ron Hickey, he got caught smuggling lobster into Rockwood. He was calling his buddies on the outside and having them meet him at the gates with this gourmet dinner. And he was using the money that they were making, because they have some work programs there. Anyways, he would go on to refer to Rockwood Jail as Rockapoco, as in a resort, as in Acapulco. And that's always stuck with me, sort of symbolic of all that's wrong with our penal system, when you've got inmates dining on lobster and comparing it to a posh tropical resort.
Well, you know, we'll leave the penal system to those in South Carolina with the hot sauce, but the nervous shock that some of these inmates are saying they've been inflicted it with because of the negligent justice system. Now, let's turn this to the other side. You know, rehabilitating the criminals, these poor nervous jailhouse thugs. What about rehabilitating the victims, and maybe that $50,000 that these knuckleheads are looking for should go to the victims instead?
Oh, money like that could go a very long way, absolutely, because we know for a fact that victims are often shortchanged by the justice system, by the government, that the long-term resources and assistance that they so desperately require often is not there. They're kind of left picking up the pieces of their shattered lives while all the efforts and the programming and the treatment and whatnot goes into the criminals who destroyed their lives. It does seem to be a very lopsided system, and I'm sure this lawsuit is only going to reinforce that belief.
What's happening with the suit itself?
Well, I believe it was just filed, so it's in its fairly early stages. You know, now they'll have an opportunity for the prison. They'll get some time to file their statement of defense. The government actually has already tried to have this thrown out. They basically saying that it's completely frivolous, and that sometimes happens when people file lawsuits that appear to be frivolous. The government filed a quick motion to get this tossed. The judge who ruled in that case, and this was just a month ago, decided against throwing it out, but has basically stayed the case for 6 months, giving the defendants some additional time to file more material. So it's possible that this may not even get to trial, that it could be bounced out of court before it even gets to that stage. That would be my prediction anyways.
Mike McIntyre is here. Speaking of that negligent justice system, let's talk about Graham James. The Crown has appealed his sentence. They're wanting a couple extra years tacked on. What's going on there?
Yeah, in a perfect segue into rehabilitation, both of accusers and of victims, because we know Graham James's victims, the former junior hockey players of the notorious Canadian junior hockey coach, we know that his many victims have had their lives destroyed by what he did to them. Hundreds of sexual assaults, using his power as their coach and as the gatekeeper, if you will, to a professional hockey career, to inflict all this this trauma on them. And for that, Graham James, well, he's now been sentenced twice. In 1997, he got 3.5 years. In 2012, he got 2 years, and that's what brings us to the current state of affairs, because the Crown is arguing that the judge badly misinterpreted the principle of punishment and of justice in only giving him 2 years. They want six. so triple the sentence that he actually got, saying that the judge put far too much emphasis on rehabilitation and remorse, that sort of thing, and not enough emphasis on punishment. Arguments were made on Monday in the Manitoba Court of Appeal. Not surprisingly, Graham James's lawyer has stood up and said, oh, no, there's nothing wrong with the sentence that was handed down. It should be kept as is. Not surprising he'd say that, Dana, because although he got a two-year sentence back in March, under our wonderful federal parole system, Graham James is actually eligible to be released any day now. He could get parole. The Court of Appeal has reserved its decision on his fate and whether to increase the sentence, but it sort of speaks volumes, doesn't it, that yeah. Graham James likely will be in the comfort of his living room when he finally learns the fate of his prison sentence.
The professional hockey players, the victims, Theo Fleury, Todd Holt, Sheldon Kennedy, etc. What are we hearing from them?
Well, they're outraged. They called the sentence, the two-year sentence, a national travesty, and I know a lot of Canadians certainly feel that way as well. You know, and for good reason, because, again, we don't have to look very far. Just look south of the border, and we've all seen, been following the story of what happened at Penn State and you know, the Sandusky case, and look at the sentence he got in a very similar type of situation, a coach in a mentorship role who sexually abused his players, just like Graham James did. But, I mean, it's not even apples and oranges to compare the two, because they're not even on the same planet. You know, while Sandusky is going to rot in prison for the rest of his miserable existence, Graham James, as mentioned, very likely could be home by Christmas in the same year that he gets sentenced. Now, it's foolish for any Canadian to think that we're ever going to go the way of the U.S. system and get sentences anything like what they do down there. But the hope is, and I think we're slowly working towards this, we're seeing more mandatory minimums now brought in for things like child sexual abuse, but it would appear Canada still sorely lacks in the punishment department when it comes to sex abusers and pedophiles like Graham James.
What's up on the show on Sunday?
That is a very good question, Dana. What are we here? We're still early in the week. You know me. I like to play it by ear. Some may call it winging it. So it should be very unpredictable as usual. But always have some interesting topics lined up to talk about for sure. Just got out of a sentencing. Actually, we're a serial arsonist who terrorized a neighborhood, cut a sweet deal that's going to keep him out of jail. Always seem to have stories like that that get people up in arms, so should be another good one.
What about Winnipeg and top of the murder list?
Winnipeg coming off a record year last year, 41 homicides in 2011. Mm. You know, it's not so much, saw the Statistics Canada report out today about the jump. I think the first time in 3 years homicides on a national level have jumped in numbers, and Winnipeg leading the way, not a distinction we want to be laying claim to. What really stuck out to me, though, Dana, is the lower solvency rate than ever. I mean, more homicides are going unsolved than ever before, and that is very alarming. Obviously, from a victim's perspective, I think the numbers are now like 1 in 4 murders in this country does not get solved. And that's, that is very alarming that 25% of killers are literally getting away with murder by not even being caught. And, of course, we could go, there's all kinds of reasons for that. You know, investigations are becoming more complex. There's more charter challenges and evidentiary challenges than ever before. And I think the big one is that we're seeing more and more gang-related crime happen in this country. People are afraid to talk. Witnesses turn a blind eye. And as a result, prosecuting these cases becomes very hard. But that, to me, is what's really standing out, that 25% of murders in this country are going unsolved. Very alarming.
Absolutely. Mike McIntyre, you can hear him Sunday nights on the Rocco and Chorus Radio Network. And I think we'll adopt a, instead of hug a thug on this program, we'll call it club a thug, maybe.
From the hot sauce.
That's right. Thank you.
Thanks.
See you, man. Bye-bye. Can you imagine in, where's they say, South Carolina, the hot sauce on the, well, whatever. I don't know. I don't get this. These thugs feeling hopeless, and they have nervous shock. It just makes you sick. These motorcycle gang guys and these thugs that another one, Christopher Brazo, who's serving time for a series of home invasions, and Bradley Rogers, who stabbed a fellow inmate 12 times. Ernest Meigs sexually assaulted multiple women at gunpoint, including his ex-girlfriend, who he abducted for 28 hours and raped repeatedly. And then there's Troy Burton. Can't forget about him, the armed bank robber convicted of uttering death threats and possession of stolen property. And, of course, they're all feeling this sense of hopelessness. I don't know. I'm Dana Pretzer. That is tonight's show. I hope you enjoyed it. And we'll see you soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of ScaredMonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.